Okay, we've got Al Cammy on the line. Al was a WTMA newsman as well as news director in the mid-70s. When exactly were you at WTMA, Al?
See, I got there in, I think it was May of 74, and left towards the end of 77. 3.5 great years. I'll tell you, it's amazing how the memories come back. I think all in our lives, we always have one or two periods of time that really stand out in your mind. And the days of WTMA certainly were that. It was a wonderful group of people. It was a lot of fun. And from a news perspective, Charleston, amazingly, was a wonderful news town.
Why was that?
I think it was a couple of things. One was a blending of different cultures that eventually found their way into Charleston. And then you had the historical culture there. So it made for a very interesting time. Southern politics had always been very vibrant, but particularly for the period of 1970 to about 1978, the South was undergoing a renaissance and shedding a lot of its old labels, and it was the New South. So it brought in New South-style politicians, a new way of doing things, and it was exciting, and it was vibrant.
Al, where were you before you came to WTMA?
I was in Indiana. My first radio job in Terre Haute, Indiana. I had graduated from Indiana State University, so I stayed on there. But I considered TMA my really first great job.
Now, did you come in as news director?
No, I came in just as morning drive news. And then a few months later, my colleague that was there, Jack Wilson, left. And I became the news director. And I was there with a woman by the name of Bernadette Woodbury. Bernadette's husband was at the medical school in Charleston. He was graduating. And then she was going to become a doctor, too. She was on her way to medical school. So, you know, I lost contact with them many, many, many years ago. But I believe Bernadette had successfully made it through medical school. And so TMA can rightfully say they helped seat another doctor.
As well as a couple of preachers, too.
Absolutely. And he's the very Reverend John Burwell.
Yes, exactly. And, of course, Booby Nash ended up being a minister, too.
Well, you know, it's pretty amazing when you follow the careers of some people. I loved broadcast journalism. It to me, was exciting. It was wonderful. It was something new every day. You got paid absolutely nothing, but it was all worthwhile for some reason. After I left Charleston, I became managing editor of an old news operation up at WFBC in Greenville, and eventually became the news director there. And in, I think it was 1981, actually, that I became news director of WSPA Television in Spartanburg. And from there, I went and became vice president of news for Nationwide Communications, which was a group of 5 television stations, and at that time, I think it was 14 radio stations. And in mid-1983, I had an offer that I couldn't refuse. Fritz Hollings was starting what turned out to be a rather ill-fated run for the presidency, and I hired on as his media consultant. Well, needless to say, nothing happened to Fritz on the way to the White House. But Washington was a wonderful city, and I became chief of staff for Congressman Butler Derrick. And then following that, I was recruited by then Martin Marietta, and I went to work in the corporate world, where I stayed until the late 90s as corporate director of communications. And in the late 90s, I retired. My father had always told me that when you're able, you always give back to the community. So for 2 years, I became president of an international technology foundation, and it was my way of trying to give back what the corporate life had been very good to me. So in 2001, I truly retired and decided that I was too young to retire and too old to go learn a young man's game. So I started a business that I've always wanted to do. I'd always been a car nut. And we now have one of the most prominent street rod shops in the country.
And that's in Florida, right?
It's in Florida. That's correct. Just outside of Orlando. I've been in the Orlando area since the early 90s. I was transferred here with then Martin Marietta and later Lockheed Martin and just loved it here.
Now, what about WTMA? Let's go back to that. I guess, would you say it's one of the coolest jobs you had? Or?
Oh, it was possibly the greatest job I had next to the one I have now.
And why was that?
It was just an amazing mix of people that if you took them all individually and looked at them as a group and said, they'll never blend. But the magic happened. John Burwell, who I consider probably one of the greatest rock historians and radio historians. Lee Richards, who was the business type. He was very staid, but it was great on air. Lee Richards on air was not Lee Richards off the air. Lee Richards left right before I did. I think Lee left in 77. And he was replaced by the Duck, Bob McLean. Bob McLean was there. I guess I was only there about 4 or 5 weeks with Bob McLean because I had already accepted the position up in Greenville. And I was working out time. Chuck Smith had asked me if I wouldn't mind staying on to help find my replacement. And I believe I was replaced by John Dozier. John was over at WCSC Radio. Boobie Nash was around. Boobie Nash was always a cut-up. Steve Russell, laid-back, just a wonderful presenter, loved music. He particularly loved Gordon Lightfoot. I remember he used to play a lot of that. And Lee Richards used to get mad at him when he'd overplay it. But Steve Russell was a wonderful guy. Gary London. Gary, we always used to kid him about being from Walterboro. We were convinced he had an old bloodhound named Old Blue that he'd sit on the porch with back in Walterbury, as we used to call it. But he was a country guy who loved rock and lived rock. Overnight was Randy, and God rest his soul, Randy was also a cut-up.
Randy Scott?
Randy Scott, who several years later, after I left, passed away in a tragic helicopter accident. He was doing traffic. But Randy did the overnights, and Randy, I mean, you never knew what to expect. I used to do the early morning drive, so I would be in there by 5 in the morning, and you'd never know what to expect. I came in one night, early one morning for my shift, and there's Randy doing the overnight show in a bra and hot pants. And you just never knew what to expect. So it made it great. You know, from the front office where John Trenton sat, John's a wonderful guy. I always have very fond memories of him. We used to go out and do what we considered to be investigative reporting back then, and John was always chomping at his fingernails, wondering when we were going to get him sued. Luckily, that never happened. But John supported us all the way. And then there's another fellow there that most people were afraid of, and that was Chuck Smith. I'll tell you, I have never met a person who was so insightful but kept to himself. He ruled the roost with an iron hand. But if you knew him, you were never afraid of him. He was just a really nice person. On the engineering side, of course, Bill Dudley was there in the early days. Then he went across town when he became a station owner. And Chuck McCann came in. Chuck was very much what an engineer would look like. He was laid back, a little stocky, didn't have much of a sense of humor. At least it didn't appear so. But as he got to know him and as he loosened up, this guy had a remarkable sense of humor. He came into the newsroom one day. I was there by myself. Steve Bell wasn't in that morning for some reason. And I'm reading a story. We used to use this yellow recycled paper that used to come off the teletype. I mean, this thing was so flammable. It was probably as flammable as gasoline. Well, I started reading a story off there, and the next thing I know, Chuck is in there, and he lights the top of the copy. So I have to read faster as the flame is coming down and burning up the copy. Needless to say, the flame got to the bottom of the copy before I did. But those are the kinds of things Chuck would do. And it was just mischief, and it was a lot of fun. And, you know, the audience never knew about it. And you tried to keep your composure as best you can, but sometimes it just wasn't possible.
Besides just doing the best you possibly can, was there a certain method to the madness of getting the news, a certain philosophy on what to do and how much to do?
Well, we did multiple newscasts in the drive times, at some points 30 minutes apart. So the key was to always try to keep it fresh, which forced us to be very much involved in the community, be very much involved with those making news, because we had to have fresh sound for every newscast. We weren't playing yesterday's stories the next morning. Everything was fresh, everything was new, every newscast. The little sound bites that they have in news called actualities, we would constantly be gathering them. Everything that happened, constantly getting a hold of people. And I can't imagine how many people absolutely hated us. I'd call congressmen at 5 in the morning at home if there was something newsworthy about what they were doing or what they were involved in. And after a while, they would get used to it. But one-time newsmakers never got used to it, getting calls in the middle of the night or early morning. I know I wouldn't have liked it.
So the news department was pretty aggressive.
It had to be. We had a limited time in which to present and the charge to keep it fresh.
Now, did that come from the programming department, the station management?
It didn't come from programming. Programming set the hour clock. We were pretty much left alone, which was very surprising. John Trenton was always very much involved in what we were doing, but never dictated what we should or should not do. And I can't ever remember one single time that Lee Richards ever did that. I think he recognized that Steve Bell, myself, and Adrell McCants, who was also there, were responsible people, that we understood the community, we understood the nature of news, and we understood radio, and we understood the formatting and how everything should work together. So they really allowed us a lot of leeway, and probably in some cases too much.
Well, it sounds like you had a passion for news. I've worked with some news people that look at it as just a job, and for them to just grab wire copy and read it on the air and maybe dub a few actualities from the network seems like, okay, we've covered the news.
Well, you know, it's funny because Steve Bell and I probably earned 50% of what we were paid for mutual. That's how many national items actually occurred in our coverage area. We would feed mutual either voice stories or combination stories on a regular basis. And back then, they used to pay, I think it was $7 a story. And we were picking up an extra $50 a week each.
Wow.
Which was, at that time, about 30% of my salary. And then when events would occur, if the president was coming to South Carolina, Mutual would call us to go cover it for them so they didn't have to send the White House correspondent. Then we also started a lot of public affairs programming, which in most stations is a necessary evil. You know, if you find a slot somewhere where nobody's listening and air it so you can meet your FCC requirements back then. Well, Steve and I got a little enterprising at 2 of the 3 years we were together. What we did is we did year-end news roundups that we syndicated to South Carolina radio stations. And we didn't know we were doing anything special. It was just that we had an amazing library that we maintained. I think in today's terms, it's probably called junk. But we maintained all the newsmaker stuff over the year. And we would do a year-end show that would air on TMA and PXI. And then somebody suggested, why don't you just try to sell it to the other radio stations? And I think the 1 year that we did it, we sold like 40 stations.
Wow.
And I think we got $20 a piece for them. It was so cool. I mean, we were rolling in money, we thought.
So you work with Steve Bell. Tell me a little bit about working with him.
I have great love for Steve. When Steve came into town, Steve stayed with Pat and I. And it was a good opportunity to kind of bring him up to speed on what was going on around town. Steve is a very smart person. He's a bright guy. He captured things very quickly. And in fact, he set direction. He was the rational one of the two of us. My reaction was, let's go get that bastard. And he'd say, no, wait a minute. You know, you can't call him a bastard yet. You don't have the facts to support that conclusion. And I got a lot of respect for Steve. He's a great guy. And he worked so damn hard. He really did. For the amount of pay we were getting, what we were being paid was abominable. When I left to go to WFBC, the key motivator was money. Oh, it was also an all-news operation. It was a serious news organization with 9 people. When I left TMA, I was making more than any other news person in radio news there. In fact, more than most TV people. I was making $200 a week. And I went to Greenville for $375 a week.
You almost doubled your income.
Exactly. And plus, we went to a dedicated news organization that news was the lead. All the time when news was the lead. Doesn't matter what else was going on air. If news had something, it went on.
Do you remember what the radio competition was like for news during the time that you were here? Was anybody else doing what WTMA was doing?
When we began, the answer is no. But by 1975, John Patterson was over at WKTM, the station that Dudley bought. And CSC was starting up. And WPAL had people. I think that was pretty much it in radio. But for a market that size, to have 4 relatively reasonably sized dedicated staff news operations was highly unusual. Now, we didn't see our competition as other radio stations. We saw our competition as the newspaper and television. As a medium, television was starting to gain, and newspapers were starting to decline, but ever so slightly. And we always considered ourselves in competition with the other media, not necessarily radio stations. And we devoted more and more time and energy and resources to ensuring that we were ahead of the competition. And I think in part, it was very much due to John Trenton. John Trenton, while he didn't steer us in that direction, didn't dissuade us from it, and he saw the advantages in it. That even though you're only doing 10-minute newscasts during drive times, and you're on a top 40 station, it doesn't mean you can't bring an audience in as a result of one programming element or another. And I think John was a smart programmer. I really believe that the quality of news contributed to the overall ratings. Nobody ever disputed that for us. Our drive times were always very strong. And by 1975, there was much more interaction between the DJ and the news person that started to develop. And it was never dissuaded, which was always good.
Now, what about studio equipment? Do you remember much about the newsroom equipment?
Oh, yeah. Even as a novice in radio, I could tell this stuff was ancient. I mean, this stuff was bad. But they kept it running. It was kind of like a Timex. Takes a licking, keeps on ticking. We had I think they had already upgraded us to either an ITC or a Revox reel-to-reel. It was a quarter-inch reel-to-reel that we had in the newsroom that we taped to and then dub it down to carts, the bytes. We had 2 or 3 cart machines stacked. So as we're reading one story, because we always used to use six or seven or eight actualities a newscast, and we'd be changing carts in the middle of, you know, as we're reading, and those things were clunkers. They'd make noise and everything, and it got terrible. I mean, you're trying to change this cart out and not make noise, but you need it in 10 seconds for the next story. And then you always have a cart that would jam. It'd start up, halfway through it, it'd start wrapping around the capstan on there, and it'd just wow out on you and just die. And you dreaded those moments, but you knew it was going to happen. You just knew it would happen. And so you had to know what was on that cart so you could at least paraphrase to people what the person said. And hopefully you say it accurately enough where you're not putting words into their mouths. I'm sure there was a time or two when Steve had left me some carts or something and he wasn't there and I threw a cart in a jam and I probably said, I got to tell you, I don't know what he said. I mean, I don't know. I don't have a clue.
When it came to getting actualities and stories from out in the field back to the radio station in a hurry, what was the technology involved in that?
The way we would do it is on the output of our recorders, we'd have a plug-in with alligator clips. We'd open up the mouthpiece of the phone, throw the microphone of the phone away, and clip directly to the terminals. And you eliminate the microphone that way. That's how we got those recordings as clear as they were. We had a microphone, we ran it through our recorder, and right into the mouthpiece, the terminals inside the mouthpiece on the phones. And one of the problems we would always have in the field is payphones did not unscrew easily. So what we'd do is we'd beat the hell out of it till it finally came loose so we could clip in.
Do you have any contact with any people that you worked with?
Yeah, some. Some people, you know, just move on and kind of disappear. But I've had contact with John Burwell. John, I consider one of my longtime, lifelong friends. I introduced him and his wife, Sylvia. My wife and I, Pat. Pat and I had been married 4 years at the time. We're now married going on 35 years. John moved into an apartment next to ours, and then we used to go on vacations together. We'd rent a house off-season down on Edisto, right on the beach. We'd just stay there for a week and cook out and walk the beaches. It was just so great. I've had marginal contact with Steve Bell, or Steve Beckham, and Brother Dave. I saw his note on your website. Brother Dave moved with his wife from Cocoa Beach to Charleston, and he and his wife and Pat and I became friends, and we spent quite a bit of time together. But I moved on, and I don't know what happened to all of these people. Now, I will tell you one thing. On the photos that you have on your website, you have a woman who's laying across a desk at WPXI.
Mm-hmm.
That is Kay Williams. She was married to a former CIA agent by the name of Horace, who became a teacher at a preparatory school up near Charlotte. They moved from Charleston to Monroe, North Carolina, I think it was 1976. And Pat and I and Horace and Kay had become very good friends, exceptional friends. And we would go away together. And we saw them several times in North Carolina, but had lost contact over the years. But that's Kay Williams, and she was the programmer for PXI when it was easy listening. Another lifelong friend from WKTM Radio, John Patterson. John came to town just a little bit before Steve Bell did. And John and I had met at a journalist party in town. He had just come to town. He'd come in from Wisconsin. He and I hit it off, and we fast became friends. John was not on the air doing news at KTM at the same time we were on the air. They had a different news block. He would call during a commercial because we had two breaks in the newscast. He would call on the hotline, and he'd tell me a joke. And I was laughing so hard, I couldn't go back on. And he knew he was doing this. And we would do it to him as well. Steve and I, at one point or another, we were both laughing, and neither of us could go back on the air. So it was a little bit of friendly competition. The absolute highlight of my time at WTMA was when we adopted our son. That was in 1976. We were coming home from Columbia, where we received custody of him, and the first stop we made was at WTMA. And the receptionist's name was Barbara, a wonderful lady. And one of the billing people was Carol Leggett, and of course, Rudy was there. And we came in with the baby, and in the booth, they went ahead and just threw an album on, and everybody came out. And we all gathered in the lobby. I mean, they just let the radio station go, Chuck Smith included. And that's when I knew we were a family. And I think if there was one event that made TMA so special, that was it. If I had to do it all over again, I don't think I would have changed anything. life is a wonderful thing. We've been very fortunate. We have two wonderful children and three wonderful grandchildren. Pat and I are as happily married today as the day we got married. And I think we fall in love more and more each day, even though we're older, shorter, and fatter than we used to be. And we're very fortunate in that we're able to do a lot of the things that we've wanted to do, like start our own business and something that we have a passion for. We employ 13 people. By extension, I think I employ 13 families and help support 13 families. We're now transitioning our company to an employee-owned company, so everybody has a vested stake. I have some of the greatest craftspeople in the country that work here, and I'm just very proud of them all, and they deserve to own this company. And one day I'll retire, and Pat and I'll, I don't know, cruise off in our sailboat in the sunset.
Well, if you're ever in Charleston, you'll have to stop by and see the radio station. And
I want to, you know, for the times that I have been in Charleston, I've always driven down Orange Grove Road, and I've come to the end, and I look at that station, and I think wonderful thoughts all the time. I don't think I could have one bad thought of being there.